Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Rethinking U.S. Defense Strategy. With me to discuss whether and how the United States should revise its defense strategy to face its current challenges is Elbridge Colby. Bridge is co-founder and principal of the Marathon Initiative, which seeks to prepare the United States for an era of great power competition. From 2018 to 2019, he was the director of the defense program at the Center for New American Security. Before that, Bridge served as the U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Force Development, where he led the development and rollout of the 2018 National Defense Strategy. His new book, The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict, is out today. Bridge, congratulations on the publication of your book and welcome back to the President's Inbox.
Many thanks, Jim. Great to be back on.
Now, you opened the book by posing a question, and I'll quote you here. What is the best defense strategy for the United States? Now, that's obviously a critical question. And whenever we talk about strategy, a strategy has to fit the circumstances it's designed to meet. So let's begin our conversation there. How do you see the current strategic situation of the United States?
Well, thanks, Jim. I mean, I think it's pretty mismatched, if not parlous, I think you would say. I mean, fundamentally, we in a way continue to act as if it's the 1990s and the 2000s, where we have a sort of global engagement strategy and certainly a heavy forward defense strategy in the three kind of key theaters around Eurasia in particular, Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. But the reality is that we're very far from the unipolar moment. I mean, I think that it was pretty evident, you know, a decade ago that moment was fading with the rise of China in particular. But now we see a really dramatic mismatch. And I think it's well past time. In fact, it's almost becoming, I'd say it's an emergency, honestly, without exaggeration, to, you know, right size and rightly orient our defense strategy to avoid frustration and I think potentially disaster.
Okay, I want to pursue that because there's a lot there. But perhaps we could sort of go at it in bite-sized chunks. First thing that jumps out at me is that when you wrote your book, your subtitle mentions great power conflict. Now, what I'm used to hearing is the term great power competition. And there's a bit of difference between conflict and competition. So help me understand why you think great power conflict is back on the agenda.
Well, I think conflict in the title is deliberately ambiguous in the sense that it could be a war. And I think war is definitely possible and in fact becoming more plausible this decade in particular. But also conflict in the more generic sense that doesn't necessarily entail violence. But I think we're already seeing this decade in the intensification of the rivalry between the United States and China in particular, the great powers of the world by far. I mean, I think in a sense, the world is becoming a bipolar structure with features of multipolarity is how I think about it. But it's clearly conflictual. And I think the evidence of how deeply rooted that is at this point is how consistent that's been across the Trump and Biden administrations. And in fact, in some ways, it's worsened under Biden. I don't mean that in a sort of moralistic sense. I mean, it's further intensified even in some ways. That's what I mean by conflict, but I certainly don't shy away from the possibility of war. I think that's very possible, sadly. We need to take active and strategic steps to avert it in a way that preserves a peace that we want, not the ideal, but something that's tolerable for us.
And I would note that defense scholars would argue that you want to craft a defense strategy in order to deter conflict, and that a smart defense strategy, if it works, will prevent you from having to go to war. But I want to talk about the big kid on the block that animates a lot of your writing, and that's the rise of China. You liken China to, let me quote you here, an object so large that it must have the greatest consequence for any system that must accommodate it. So just sort of walk me through how you see the rise of China threatening, and I think that's the right word, U.S. interests. Where is it threatening U.S. interests? How is it threatening U.S. interests?
Sure. And I think this is a critical point. I'm not sure it's been really detailed. I think a lot of the discussion around China, and I think both in the Trump and the Biden administrations, was sometimes sort of abstract terms like rules-based international order or excessively ideological to focus on communism, for instance, in a way that I don't think is very well-founded. My view is, and it's actually something I'm thinking about writing about more going forward, is that basically China has a very strong incentive to create a hegemonic position in Asia in particular. particular.
Okay, that's a big word. I gotta invoke the big word alert. What do you mean by a hegemonic position? Since a lot of people listening to us talk would say, well, the United States is the hegemon.
Right. Well, we're not anymore. I don't think we're the global hegemon if we ever were, but we're certainly not the global hegemon. I mean, we are hegemon. I mean, the predominant power. Basically, I think for a variety of reasons, direct imperial control has gone out of fashion. We can kind of unpack why that is, but I think the evidence is out there for us to see. But hegemony is a different thing. It's kind of a soft dominance, a softer form of dominance, where countries are independent, maybe just nominally, but they basically have to get a buy or leave or even more in order to make their security policies, their important international political decisions, and their economic decisions. And I think ultimately this is a pocketbook issue for the United States. Because look, Asia is rising to be roughly 50% of global GDP. It's going to be by far the world's largest market, and its share is growing. If a country like China is dominant over that region, you can absolutely be sure that they will use that leverage to impose their will on Americans' economic prosperity and security, and ultimately their freedoms. And frankly, I mean, every day the Chinese get ahead of the examples that you could come up with to try to, you know, speculate about what that might look like. And I'll take the example of Australia, which has been suffering under Chinese economic coercion for the last few months. China has issued 14 demands that include changes to Australia's domestic legislation. That is the future if China dominates Asia. And I think that's a very real prospect. And I mean, it's an extension of China's own internal political economic model of state control, you know, and trying to essentially cluster the commanding heights of industrial and economic activity in China and take it away from the United States, of higher education, of all the things that we now take for granted. I mean, America's so accustomed to being dominant, certainly after the Cold War, and in some ways going back to the Second World War, that we kind of can't imagine what that's like, but China can, and they're pursuing. And that's what I think, that's the danger, and that threat is very, very immediate and very real. And in some ways, actually, Jim, I actually think the American people, obviously that's a sort of an abstract term, but I think a lot of Americans out beyond the Beltway experience this more immediately than the blob, because people have felt deindustrialization. They feel that economic insecurity. They feel, you know, the implications of the social control elements that we could see China imposing. So I actually think at that level, and you see it in the polling data, American people, I think, understand that China is a very serious threat in this way, although it's obviously inchoate in how people express. And that's one of the things I'm trying to give a kind of more detailed, explicit explication to.
Okay, Bridge, I want to come back to the American public, but we can put that off for the moment. I want to just pursue this idea, if I understand you correctly, that China's rise will give China the ability to dominate certainly the region, I guess we now call it the Indo-Pacific, by virtue of its economic size. In some ways, it's an economic black hole, gravitational pull on all others. That you're not worried necessarily that the Chinese are going to go out and conquer the rest of the Indo-Pacific because, as you point out, sort of old-fashioned imperialism or conquest is passé. So an immediate question becomes one of, how does a defense strategy work against what seems to be primarily an economic threat?
Sure. I actually think the military element is very central, and it's often underestimated. And I think it's becoming more central for a variety of reasons. And I actually really worry that the Biden administration shares the view that you just stated. And you've seen it, in fact, in the pages of Foreign Affairs, Jake Sullivan and Kirk Campbell, and they're very important and in many respects, you know, excellent article a few years ago, basically said that China will be an economic and a political and ideological challenge, but not a military challenge. They pull back right before saying it that explicitly, but that's certainly the vibe. And I think that's wrong. And that's for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is that I think basically countries in the region, at the end of the day, most of them are the powerful ones, don't want to fall under Chinese hegemony. I mean, what I'm talking about is a situation in which Japan, Taiwan, Australia, Vietnam, India have to basically do what China says about really important things. And we already see that they're not doing that. Australia is holding firm. India is holding firm. They just banned a whole bunch of Chinese apps. Japan is holding firm. Taiwan is holding, even Taiwan, right? Which is in many ways, almost always the most vulnerable. So that basically says countries have a lot of will to stand up. The second is that economic coercion only goes so far. And I think the Chinese are realizing this. I mean, we ourselves, our experience has shown how limited the power of economic coercion alone is. In fact, even bombing and kind of standoff or sort of targeted military application is really limited, especially when you're talking about pushing a country to accept something they really don't want to accept. So, I mean, we've had a blockade on Cuba for, I don't know, 60 years now. North Korea, North Vietnam, we had a blockade on Iraq, Iran. Iraq's a great example. I mean, we had Iraq, UN Security Council, economic sanctions, and Saddam Hussein still resisted George W. Bush's pressure in 2002. So I think China's recognizing that as well. That's good in some sense, because it means what I call it, you know, the anti-hegemonic coalition has a lot of, you know, confidence that it can stand up against Chinese economic coercion. But the downside is that's going to increase the allure of the military instrument for China, assuming that they're really serious about it. And I think they are. And I mean, I think, you know, don't take it from me. Look, they are building a military. It's not anymore just an anti-access area denial military. And that's basically a military that's designed to block the United States from projecting power close to China. Yes, they're doing that, and it's really formidable. But they're also developing what's called a power projection military. And that's what our military is. That's aircraft carriers. That's a space architecture. That's nuclear-powered submarines. And we can go into it. But that is very clear evidence that they want to project power. That's a military you build if you want to impose direct military force on recalcitrant countries in your region. And they're doing it. I mean, they literally were stabbing Indian soldiers on the line of actual control in Ladakh. You know, and they're saying that, they're pretty much saying that they'd use military force against Taiwan. So, I mean, you don't have to be that. I mean, I think if we looked back, you know, if there were a war in 3 years and we look back from here, we would say, well, they expressed their intent. So that's kind of where we are, I think.
Okay. So if I understand you correctly, you want to have a smart defense strategy because you think that that is going to be critical first for, in essence, helping support our friends, partners, and allies when they have to stand up against China, because it helps to have a sense that there's somebody with you in a tough moment, but also because you are worried about direct Chinese military action, or the Chinese will, may believe that once they build this bigger military, and I agree with you on the issue of force protection, that it's actually going to be effective to delivering important political objectives to them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think the way I think of what we are is like the external cornerstone balancer. It's a bit of a clunky term, but...
But political scientists love it. It's meat and potatoes to us, Bridge.
Now I can retire. No, but the, you know, it's basically the idea, look, if you're raising money for, you know, your business or your nonprofit, or you're trying to put together a conference, it really helps to have like a big name, a strong cornerstone. You know, then you go out and you say to other people, hey, join up. Jeff Bezos has already invested, or Elon Musk or whatever. That's people will, it'll be a lot easier to get people to go along. That's kind of the role the U.S. plays. Then everybody else in the region, certainly Japan and India, but also the Vietnams, the Taiwans, they will think it's more prudent to affiliate with us and stand up for themselves, not do us any favors, and vice versa. And this is not, I should stress, this is not about some kind of vague standing up for the rules-based international order. Honestly, my preference would be for us to have a more restrained, my personal preference would be to, you know, I like to, I don't know if I like to, but I think that in my adult life, I've supported one war, which was the narrow counterterrorism war after 9/11 against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan, not the subsequent nation building. But I would rather America, you know, really pull back the military instrument as much as possible. But if you look at it analytically, if we do that, China's going to kind of eat up the region by doing what I like to think of as the kind of the focused and sequential strategy. It's basically picking them off one at a time, right? Like what Bismarck did in the 19th century in forming Germany. And I think
the Chinese have studied Bismarck among other strategists as they compiled their foreign policy and defense policies.
Yeah, I think they are. And they're very smart, and they're doing a really good job in a lot of ways, and in some ways not. But yeah, I think that's what we need. So, and then I think our defense strategy should be a little bit like the police in a neighborhood where you're thinking of investing, say, or you're buying a house. If you get it right, then you can worry about economic development, economic competition. But if you don't get it right, forget it. Nothing else matters. And that's kind of where we need to be. And so I'm sort of obsessively focused on the defense piece precisely in order to make it unimportant, which is where we want to get to.
Bridge, I want to ask one more big picture question. Then we can talk a bit more about your ideas for the strategy of denial. And the question really is, going back to your observation about China being so big and the system having to accommodate it, is there any place you look at regionally that the United States should accommodate China? Or is it, in essence, where you look at it, U.S. strategy should in some way try to sort of freeze the world as it exists today?
I think basically our defense perimeter should be along the first island chain, so maritime Asia. Look, I think...
You may need to define that, because I'm not sure everybody has a mental image of what the island chains are in East Asia.
Yeah, I think basically where most of the wealth of Asia is, and where our traditional allies are, and where our military advantage is the strongest, is in the maritime and aerospace domains. And that basically means the Western Pacific, littoral and peninsular and insular countries. So Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Philippines, maybe Vietnam, maybe Indonesia, certainly Australia, India. That's kind of our wheelhouse. And if we can bring some, you know, coalition of those countries together and lead them and stand up to China, we will have agglomerate enough power to be able to make the Chinese respect our collective interests sufficiently. But I think by the same token, I don't think we're going to be able to do much for Mongolia or Kyrgyzstan or frankly, Afghanistan and frankly, Russia. And I think Russia will increasingly have a very pointed choice. I mean, you know, sort of Russia's obviously the relationship with China now is closer than it's been in 50 years since before the Sino-Soviet split, I think most people think. But, you know, the paradox is if Russia's strategy with China works and China is more ascendant in Asia, Russia will be increasingly vulnerable. And I mean, I don't think there's any reason to think that the Chinese will treat the Russians better than they've treated the Japanese, the Indians, the Taiwanese, the Vietnamese, the Australians, etc. I mean, in fact, you know, people point out the century of humiliation. Well, I think one of, if not the most acquisitive power against China was Tsarist Russia. I mean, took huge tracts of land from, I think, the Qing or before the Qing. Others will know better. But there are potential territorial disputes there, too. So I think, you know, our business is basically the Pacific, the Western Pacific, and Southeast Asia and South Asia. But Central Asia and terrestrial Eurasia, there's not much we can do or should really try to do.
Okay, so we've now discussed sort of the strategic environment and the challenges facing the United States. I know your answer to the situation we face is a strategy of denial, but I'm not sure what that means. What would a strategy of denial look like, and what are we denying?
Sure. I think it's a twofold meaning. There's a geopolitical level, and then there's a military level. So geopolitically, basically, it means we're denying China hegemony. It's a negative goal, which sounds kind of bad, but actually is good. It's a more restrained goal than what we've been pursuing, particularly since the end of the Cold War. These, I think, delusions of grandeur to turn the world into liberal internationalism or the neoconservative project or pacify it or so forth. No, this is a narrow, specific goal, which is to say we are going to deny China's ability to dominate the world's largest market area. And from that position, become globally preeminent, I should add, because it's not just about Asia. It will, because it's the world's most important region, it will have global implications. Then from a military perspective, you know, and getting back to what, you know, countries' willingness to stand up for their autonomy and their independence, the military strategy of denial is to say, look, what we need to do is actually, we don't need to dominate China. We don't need to dismember it. We don't need to regime change it. We don't need to invade and occupy it like we did Iraq, ill-advisedly, in my view, in 2003 and so forth. No, what we need to do is deny China its objectives, sufficient to keep those vulnerable members of our coalition standing strong. And that's actually a variable goal. It actually could be quite low. I mean, if you look at like a Vietnam or Finland, for instance, these are countries that probably can hold on their own and suffer a lot to stand up. So actually, the requirements for us might be relatively modest. But the basic goal is we need to do, our military strategy needs to be able to give enough support to those allies and partners and important partners, particularly Taiwan, in my view, that they will be able to hold on and continue affiliating with us. And if we can do that, then I think we'll achieve the geopolitical goal. And hopefully China will see that and never test it because they'll see that it would backfire for them.
Okay, I want to make sure I'm following you here, Bridge. What I'm hearing you saying is that you want the United States to craft a strategy that is less interested in creating something than it is from preventing something from happening. In that sense, it's a more limited goal. Second aspect of what I'm hearing from you is that you're not suggesting that the United States needs to substitute itself, its military, its blood and treasure for the efforts of its allies, but in essence, to work in such a way as to create a space so that the allies take on much of their defense responsibilities of their own. But it's not like separate tracks, it's a related track.
I think your first point, Jim, is absolutely fair. It is a negative goal. It's more about preventing and a kind of a status quo rather than a active transformational goal, which I think is more just, more feasible, more in line with what Americans will be prepared and rightly are prepared to sacrifice and risk. To your second point about allies, absolutely. I think this model involves much more active allied contributions. I mean, I think in the days of Donald Rumsfeld, even going back to the Clinton administration, I think there was a sense that, you know, allies were nice for the flags they might have provided on a ship. But really, it was basically the Americans and maybe the Brits and the Australians who were going to do things. No way. That's not where we are anymore. And that's, you know, fundamentally because we don't have the power anymore, right? And I mean, especially because we do have interests in Europe and the Middle East that are important. They're not as important as Asia, but we still need to handle that. Now, it's going to have different implications for different countries based on how strong they are, where they are, whether they face China directly or Russia or Iran or something. But I think the basic point is absolutely the model here is a much more shared burden. And I think going back, in a sense, more to something like the Cold War, particularly the latter Cold War military strategy, where, you know, I mean, the Germans have basically demilitarized, but in 1988, the Germans had 12 active divisions, the Bundeswehr, the West Germany, which was two-thirds of the current Federal Republic. That's basically what Japan should look like, in my view, and certainly Taiwan. South Korea is actually already in a pretty good place. And I think our military, you know, our militaries with those of the Japanese should be much more thoroughly integrate. In other places like Europe, I think we should basically draw down. We should remain in NATO, contribute sort of at the high end, but really the Europeans should be responsible for their own, primarily for their own conventional defense, because they can handle it. That's even more the case in the Middle East.
You know, Bridges, I look at the Indo-Pacific, I'll note two things. Number one, almost all of our traditional friends, partners, and allies want us to be there, want to see us make the Indo-Pacific a priority. Number two, many of those countries are worried that we may not remain there because, unlike them, we have the option to come home. And I think that's one of the reasons why, if you look at certainly treaty allies, I'm thinking Japan, South Korea, and Australia, they have been making significant investments in their own militaries, precisely because they're A, worried about China, and they're worried about the fact that the United States may go home, and they want to answer the criticisms that they're free riding off of the United States. Now, I think for most Americans listening to this, you know, hear the words treaty allies, Japan, Australia, South Korea, and they think to themselves, well, we're going to stand by our word and we will stand for them. The one country I've heard you mention that doesn't fit that bill that you want to stand by is Taiwan. Obviously, 1979, Jimmy Carter rips up the mutual defense treaty with Taiwan because he wants to establish formal diplomatic relations with mainland China. Walk me through why it's important for the United States to make a commitment and what kind of commitment it should make to Taiwan, because we don't, at least formally, have a commitment that we will defend Taiwan in the face of Chinese aggression.
Well, no, it's a great question, but let me step back because I have a different frame for thinking about the relationship between our treaty allies and Taiwan and so forth.
Fair enough.
Fundamentally, these treaty alliances are not declarations of love or marriage or whatnot. They are strategic partnerships and they can be exited. I mean, and frankly, actually, if you look at the wording of the mutual defense treaties with our Asian allies, they're actually pretty anemic. I mean, they basically say that the parties will consult their internal domestic processes and respond. Basically, why we think they're more is because we've built expectations and custom over the last 70 years that that is what would happen. And we've postured ourselves and behaved in that way. But I think the allies that, particularly the Australians, deserve a lot of credit. The South Koreans, despite the pressure they got under the Trump administration, actually spent a lot on defense, deserve credit. They're right. And I think one of the real mistakes that both President Biden, but also President Bush 43 have made is over reassuring, which is both, you know, doesn't make a lot of sense because, you know, Americans should want other countries to contribute more. I think President Trump could have had a more constructive approach to doing that. But that is, and President Obama actually was quite similar to President Trump in his basic orientation on that, obviously a very different approach. But I think over reassurance is both doesn't make a lot of sense, both in just an immediate sense, but also it's wrong and it's very dangerous to our allies. And I think the Afghanistan decision that President Biden has made has shown that. I mean, Afghanistan was not a treaty ally, but there were plenty of commitments to Afghanistan that President Biden just blew right through. And I think, in a sense, he's been reassuring all of our allies in the last few months. But basically, the job of the President of the United States is to serve the interests of the American people. And our defense strategy, and particularly the way we fight a war, has to correlate the costs and risks that the American people are asked to endure to the interests at stake. And so, you know, all of these sort of peons to our allies and our friends, and, you know, these are business partnerships, basically. And we should speak of them in that way. That doesn't mean that they're not very deeply rooted and important. In fact, I really think they are. And I think the way that I'm talking about them is actually much more likely to sustain them. But I think countries are right to be thinking about this, no matter what our political leaders are saying.
Well, points or points taken. I will grant you that. But let's talk about Taiwan. How does that fit into this strategy of yours?
Right. So Taiwan is a very tough issue. It's not a cut and dried issue. And to your point, I think it could be variable based, for instance, on how much the Taiwanese themselves do, which gets at the costs and risks endured. Look, I think there are a couple things why Taiwan is important. One is it's militarily significant. So I talked about earlier about how our wheelhouse as a nation is aerospace and maritime power. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of World War II nostalgia, but I mean, I think the Red Army inflicted 80 to 90% of casualties on the Wehrmacht. But the American Navy beat the Japanese Navy in a fair fight at Midway. Now, that was a long time ago, but I mean, I think it was the last major war. I mean, we were fought to a standstill by the Chinese, essentially, in the Korean War. We were defeated in Vietnam. The Iraqis were an exception, but I think we could go into that. It's crazy to get in the land war in Asia for America. We're a democracy, we're a volunteer military, etc. Where we're really good is high technology and maritime and aerospace. Okay, so that's the Western Pacific. That's one thing. The problem is the island of Taiwan is very important for the military disposition of the Western Pacific. Essentially, and if you listen to Japanese leaders recently, it is critical to the defense of Japan, which is the most important ally. It's essentially the cornerstone of our joint position in Asia. Japan's the most sophisticated, large economy in the region. So, you know, if China seized Taiwan or Taiwan was incorporated into China, essentially China would have uninhibited power projection into the Central Pacific. Pacific. So we would essentially be talking about a repeat potentially of battles of the Second World War in the Central Pacific, and would put enormous pressure on the Philippines and Japan and South Korea. So militarily, it's significant. Secondly, it's very important for what I think of as differentiated credibility. Now, I differ from a lot of foreign policy types in that I don't think our credibility matters everywhere. You know, I think people make more kind of focused assessments about our credibility. Look, if you cheat at cards, you may still be a reliable, you know, guy to lend money to. Similarly, if the United States gets out of Syria or Afghanistan, that's different than what we're doing in Asia.
I share your view.
In fact, it may actually indicate our seriousness about Asia because we're bringing down. And that's why I think the president's decision to withdraw from Afghanistan was absolutely right, even if it was catastrophically handled, in my view. But I think that the issue with Taiwan, and where I differ from your assessment, is that treaties are one thing, but I actually don't think most Americans even know who our treaty allies are. And actually, you know, I think that polling suggests that. Rather, Taiwan, our behavior and our rhetoric, certainly, in fact, even more under President Biden, does suggest a commitment. So, you know, if you go back to 1990, Saudi Arabia was not a treaty ally of the United States, but we came to its defense, and Kuwait, and it was expected. Israel is not a treaty ally, but I think people...
Oh, I wasn't meaning to suggest that the U.S. commitment to defend others is limited to those with whom it has a formal treaty. I'm just suggesting that clearly where the United States has a formal treaty commitment, it has signaled. And again, not because we're doing it for charitable reasons, because we think it's in our interest to have those treaties, that we will defend them. Taiwan's in a different space because the nature of the American commitment is, if I can put it this way, ambiguous. That's why we have strategic ambiguity.
But I think our credibility is on the line. So I think, you know, the Taiwan Relations Act, the six assurances are now public, but also people in Asia, the people who matter for us in this respect, the security decision makers in the region, they do look at Taiwan as the canary in the coal mine. And that's why it matters. Some people also think the fact that it's a democracy and it would be fall under Chinese domination is also significant. That's a third reason. I don't emphasize that as much. But I think those three reasons make it critical. But again, the point here is that the cost and risk, because Taiwan, it's not a cut and dried issue. It's important for us, but it's not existential. So if we can develop a military strategy that doesn't, you know, require that we do something that puts our existence at risk or something, you know, very, very costly or risky, then it will make sense to defend it. But if we can't do it, then we will have to pull back. But that would be bad. And that's one of the reasons I want to focus on Taiwan, because the areas where you need the best military strategy are precisely the ones that aren't clear cut.
Well, you've anticipated the question that I wanted to ask you, Bridge, and that is, what would this strategy look like in practical terms? I understand the logic. I actually agree with much of the logic that you have laid out. But there comes the question of whether you can actually enact a strategy that will work in the ways that you want it to work, because the fact that you want to have an outcome doesn't mean you have the ability to effectuate that outcome. So how do you think about that challenge?
Well, I mean, I think about it a lot. I mean, in a sense, the national defense strategy that I worked on in the Pentagon with a great team under Secretary Mattis, I mean, that essentially was putting us in this direction. I mean, this is not a bureaucratic document where there were a lot of compromises and all that, but basically—
Yes, the book reads much better than most Pentagon reports. I will grant you that. But that may just be damning you with faint praise,
exactly,
which I don't mean to do.
But to your point, there has been limited progress, even though the defense strategy of the United States has pointed in this direction. But I think what this would look like is basically a lethal and resilient military posture and capability that is specifically designed, especially to defeat either an invasion or a blockade of Taiwan. And by extension, it could then do it for the Philippines, Japan, South Korea, et cetera. And that's largely an aerospace and maritime force. A lot of missiles, a lot of torpedoes, a lot of mines, a lot of resilient space architecture, logistics architecture to project power, integrated with allies, very good, what's called C4ISR, command and control and communications, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, basically the brain and nerves of our military that can take a hit and keep on ticking. That's what it would look like. Not a big ground force, not a lot of artillery and tanks, and kudos to the Marine Corps for getting rid of a lot of that stuff. Not a lot of short-range aviation whose bases are going to get blown up. That's what it would look like. So I think we actually have a pretty clear picture. And I'm very sympathetic to the so-called Achmanek criterion, Dave Achmanek of the RAND Corporation. Look, if we can sink 350 PLA ships in 72 hours in the early stage of an invasion of Taiwan, we're pretty good. I mean, some people say that's too simplistic, but my experience of enormous bureaucracies is it's better to be too simplistic than too nuanced or complex, because there's already enough confusion in these huge bureaucracies. So that's what I'm trying to drive home here.
So I'm curious on that question, Bridge. Is the Pentagon moving quickly enough in the direction of the strategy you favor? And I ask that because, A, the Pentagon is a big organization. It has lots of different demands being made on it by others. And it has sort of the overhang of tradition. I mean, the sort of strategy you lay out suggests that the Air Force and the Navy are the big winners, if I can put that in air quotes, and the Army, maybe the Marines to a lesser extent, less important. And we know that there's inter-service rivalries. People want resources. So are you seeing the Pentagon move in the direction it should? And is it going quickly enough?
There's been progress, but it's absolutely not quick enough. In fact, it's so insufficient that I find myself really worried about a war happening this decade and our losing it. I mean, my sort of gut says that's extreme or an exaggeration. But when you look at the numbers, you look at China's behavior, you look at the military balance, that's basically the future we're walking into. And we're not making the hard choices. I mean, we're not getting, you know, we're not cutting a lot of Army force structure. We're not basically getting out of Europe conventionally, for instance. And yeah, we're investing, but it's not enough. And it's not quick enough. I mean, one of the things with, I mean, this was true. I think there was real effort under the Trump administration. And I think a lot of the leaders in the Biden Pentagon are also sympathetic to this general approach, but there's not enough money to go around often, despite it being a huge budget. And I'd rather spend less. But as you say, there's a lot of log rolling that goes on. And that's partially the Pentagon, it's partially Congress, et cetera, et cetera. Also, this Pentagon submission is very focused on the long term, it appears. But look, as Admiral Davidson said, the former commander of Indo-Pacific Command, the Chinese might invade before 2027. And we're just not in a good place. And the other thing is the allies aren't doing what they need to do. I mean, the Taiwanese are woefully behind. I mean, I would say that the Taiwanese are in serious jeopardy of doing so little that we will be compelled to abandon them. And the Japanese are also in a similar situation where I think we actually have a crisis in the U.S.-Japan relationship because, yeah, there's some good words from the prime minister, the defense minister, the deputy defense minister, the foreign minister, et cetera, but they're still spending 1% of their GDP on defense. I mean, the Chinese are a much larger economy already and spend more than twice that. And the simple fact is we are falling behind further and further behind. I'm really, really worried, actually. And I really don't want a war. But I think history and common sense suggest that the way you really don't have a war is you present the other ambitious guy with a very credible and tangible prospect of defeat and frustration. We can't be in a situation where our Kirk Campbell said to the Financial Times, I think a few weeks ago or months ago, oh, if they invade Taiwan, we'll have economic blockade or economic warfare. It's not going to happen. You know, Larry Fink is going to call the president and say,
Larry Fink is the chairman of the board of BlackRock.
Very the largest asset manager in the world. I don't know Larry Fink.
And I should mention a member of the board of directors of the Council on Foreign Relations. So we have full disclosure.
I'm not trying to go after Larry Fink per se, but I'm just saying that people who have heavy exposure to China are going to say in the United States, not to mention in Japan, in Europe, etc. The Chinese are basically going to do a fait accompli, which basically means they're going to overrun the place and say, look, you can try to turn this around, but it's going to be really costly. It's going to be really risky for you. And you're probably going to fail. And you're going to look like the aggressor and the crazy one. So, you know, like,
so something along the lines of what we saw in Crimea. Once it's a fait accompli, the rest of the world may issue stiff diplomatic notes, but eventually
adjust. From Monty Python, I will taunt you a second time, but it's not going to do much.
Okay. I take your point, your concerns about Japan's defense spending limited by 1% of GDP, and that's as historical roots. It will be interesting to see the outcome of the leadership contest in the Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP, the ruling party in Japan, because I believe the leading candidates favor spending more on defense, but so did Shinzo Abe and I think Prime Minister Suga. I really, though, share your concerns about whether Taiwan's doing enough. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the answer to that is no, and that what they're doing is the wrong things. But leaving that aside and recognizing time, I realize I didn't get to all the questions I wanted to get to with you, Bridge. Certainly didn't get to the question of American public opinion and the rest. But I want to close on a question that may be occurring to some of the people who are listening to our conversation. And it will go something like this. You know, there's an edict which you seem to be promoting, which is if you want peace, prepare for war. That's how you deter. There's a whole other line of thinking which says if you prepare for the worst, you will get the worst. That in essence, prophecies can become self-fulfilling and that by sort of posing China as our number one priority, we are encouraging Chinese who feel the reverse toward us. We're empowering them and we're locked in that death spiral. How do you think about that line of argument?
Sure. Look, I think it's a legitimate concern. I mean, this is not an easy question. I mean, we can see the Chinese are, their backs are up. I mean, for a variety of reasons, but I think they feel like they're put out as well. But I think, look, the reality is we have to make difficult choices in a situation where there are no easy ones to make. But I would say the security dilemma, a couple things. I think the security dilemma problem is addressable within the context of the strategy I'm talking about. I mean, basically, I'm saying what our strategic goal should be is essentially align and then respect our interests across that line. On their side of the line, they have a lot of autonomy. And I mean, that's going to be unfortunate for countries, some countries that don't want to be, some countries like Cambodia, Saudi or Pakistan might want to be affiliated with the Chinese. Okay, we'll deal with that. We're not going to try to change your government. We're not going to humiliate you. We're not going to dismember you. We're going to respect you. In fact, the degree of respect we have for you is so great that you are our priority country, right? I mean, that's how much we respect China. And it's not just rhetoric. It's visible in the evidence of the military that would be developed, the posture, the military forces, et cetera. Air, sea forces, these are not good for invading and occupying a country. I'm not saying we should build a large army to go and invade China and humiliate and burn down the Summer Palace again, this kind of thing. You know, you can tell. And just as I'm looking at the Chinese military, that's increasingly power projection, that's clearly designed to impose its will on others. If they look at our military and it's full of missiles and aircraft and ships, that's very clearly a defensive military. Now, defensive, it's subjective. Okay. But that's, you know, I think it's pretty much there. And from our point of view, if we're thinking about, I think the Chinese, if they're really honest, which they don't have necessarily have an incentive to be, they will see that. The other thing is, if we're thinking about that and we recognize that the Chinese are never going to give us the satisfaction of saying, hey, don't worry about it, we don't have a security dilemma. Okay, if we underprepare, then we run the risk that they will do what I fear, which is use the focused and sequential strategy to basically impose their will on Asia. If we overprepare, one possibility is we waste money because the Chinese weren't as dangerous as we thought. But I think that's not as bad as the scenario of China basically imposing its will on the region. Or there's some kind of a spiraling aspect that's rarely kind of specified. But I think that's manageable. And I think that's sort of, again, that's much preferable to a situation in which, you know, Asia is dominated by China and our lives are being essentially determined by decision makers in Beijing. I don't want that. And so I think, you know, I would rather overprepare in a way where we try to think about the security dilemma aspects. The other thing I'll say is over time, and one of the things I think in the Trump administration, this is something certainly I was focused on. I think people like Matt Pottinger were also focused on, is we need to send a strong signal now because China's kind of gotten a huge leap on us over the last 25 years because we've been focused on the Middle East and we had these crazy policies of embracing, you know, responsible stakeholder type stuff. So now we have to catch up and countries in the region have to see that we're serious and we're going to stick around precisely because of the concerns you raised. So we have to be kind of sharp and forceful and overdo it. Once we've established that we mean business and that we're sticking around, that we're going to stand strong and we've gotten our military in the right shape, then we can look forward to Tom. I think that's actually the goal for me. And this is where I differ from a lot of, I mean, people call me a hawk on China. I don't like the term hawk or dove because I think somebody should be a hawk or dove based on context. I was accused of being a dove on Iran 10 years ago, so now I'm a hawk. I don't know. I think we should be a hawk on China now, but over time, I think I would want to get to a place where we could get to detente and then we could have a decent peace.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Elbridge Colby, co-founder and principal of the Marathon Initiative. Bridge's new book, The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict, has just come out. I recommend it highly. Bridge, as always, great to talk to you. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much, Jim. It's a pleasure.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.